On the evening on the 9th of November, I wasn't at home. I visited a friend and I bicycled down Kurfürstendamm, where all the big department stores are, and suddenly I smelled something. And I thought, what smell is it? It was so unusual. I said, I know this smell. I know this smell from visits in East Berlin, but how comes that this smell is here? And then I went further down Kurfürstendamm, and then I looked up and I saw all of the Trabis around there, Trabants. And then it slowly came into my mind, wow, the wall has opened.
Billy Pitke was a student in West Berlin in 1989. She remembers the fall of the Berlin Wall, not from the TV pictures, but from the blue noxious haze of the East German cars. Another West Berliner, Jürgen Mümmelt, was also taken by surprise. Jürgen Mümmelt was a bus driver on Route 99, driving a select few passengers on one of the only routes between East and West.
As I drove my bus into the terminus at Potsdam-Drewitz in the East, I couldn't believe my eyes. I suddenly saw 300 to 400 people standing there waiting for the bus, and usually there were 10 to 20 at the most. As I then drove my bus across the border into West Berlin, everyone clapped with joy. They were all shouting and weeping. It was incredibly moving. When I arrived at my final stop, I phoned my bosses back at headquarters and told them to send as many buses as quickly as possible, because there were hundreds of people waiting to cross into West Berlin. And it wasn't until after I'd finished work that evening and was watching it all on the news that I realised the full impact of the situation.
To my right, hundreds of East Berliners queuing up, waiting to be...
Berliners were on the move, reclaiming their city. It was turmoil. I'd been visiting Berlin, both sides, since 1980, enjoying its weird emptiness. But as I joined the celebrations in 1989... all I remember is the crazy chaos.
There is a huge surge of people here on the eastern side of the Berlin Wall. The first East Berliners are reaching the other side as I speak to you, and there's a huge cheer going up from the West Berlin.
Berlin had been divided for 28 years. How could it be expected to function normally? Trains, gas, electricity, roads, postal services, the whole fabric of the city had been ripped in two. It urgently had to be stitched together again to stop it collapsing. The man in charge was the mayor of West Berlin, Walter Momper.
Mr. Momper, fighting his way through the international camera crews, what are your feelings at this moment, Mr. Momper?
Well, I think we all have the feeling it's an historic moment that here the traffic can flow back again on the Potsdamer Platz as it did in the old Berlin.
It started really on October 29th when Herr Schabowski, who was the number two in the GDR in that times, told us that they will give freedom of traveling, as he called it. And we said, well, tell us before, because we have to prepare, you have to prepare. And he said, yeah, he'll do it. And on November 9th, he didn't tell us before. And then it started on that very night after he had made this proposal.
So you didn't know it was going to happen on November the 9th? You really didn't?
No, we didn't, no. And from then on, the biggest problem on the one hand was the transport, because we calculated with 500,000 visitors coming then. Really, after November 9th, it was 1 million a day.
The flow of people to the west has become so great that the East
Berlin... last night, of course, thousands went over...
Before its division, Berlin had a vast sprawling transport system of buses, trams and trains.
Mostly they come by the S-Bahn, the district railway which weaves its way...
But in 1961, the networks were chopped brutally in half.
And you could feel the noose now fastened around the neck of West Berlin...
with only three lines still running through the centre.
All links between the two sides are closed, even the underground, which used to be a route to freedom for so many East Berliners. Only a few yards from...
There was only one S-Bahn line and one underground line which came over the border. And no bus lines. We had one bus line going to Potsdam through it. And that means for transporting, then as we got to know, after November 9th, 1 million people a day. That was a big problem.
They're coming in over the crossing point, and the city authorities in West Berlin, they've extended bus and U-Bahn underground services, and of course East Berliners who arrived there...
There was one easy step the authorities were able to make in the early days, to reopen the Geisterbahnhöfe, or ghost stations. For 28 years, three lines, the U6, U8 and the Nord-Südbahn, had started and ended in West Berlin, but been forced to run under East Berlin. Over the years, the 15 stations on these eastern routes were sealed off to the public.
A dead and empty space cleared by the communists to prevent escapes and guarded by two solitary members of the People's Police.
One of these ghost stations was at Nordbahnhof, bang on the border, where I'd arranged to meet Udo Dittfurt, an urban planner and director of Berlin's S-Bahn Museum.
Standing here, you can see on the right the former wall at the Bernauer Straße. The station itself was situated in East Berlin, directly at the border. One of the entrances goes directly to West Berlin.
So Nordbahnhof was one of the several ghost stations, one of the deserted stations during the GDR. So let's just go and have a look. I mean, Udo, give us an idea of what this station would have been like in the GDR before the wall came down.
The doors were bricked up. The lights were very dim. And when you sit in a train passing by, you could see East German policemen standing there with automatic rifles controlling the station. So it was a very dark and fearful atmosphere.
And it was frightening passing through these ghost stations, which I did often in the 1980s. West Berliners Torsten Utterbartel and Oliver Hoffmann have equally vivid memories.
When the trains passed through the East Sector, as we used to call it in the West, they drove very slowly and people didn't speak to each other. It was almost complete silence in the carriages, as if they were suspending their breath. You noticed an audible sigh of relief from all the passengers after the trains had passed through the station to the west. My mother was from the east originally, and for her, it was always a very emotional experience.
Just 2 days after the wall fell, in the glare of the world's press, and with 3,000 Berliners crowding the platform, the ghost station at Janowitzbrücke was reopened.
The train stopped, and I got out of the train, and the platform was full. Everybody was there just looking. They didn't want to go anywhere. They just wanted to see the station.
I thought at the time that if I didn't grab this moment, I might miss it, because people were still afraid that the borders might go up again. It was a Monday, and I remember bunking off school just to see the station opened. I didn't want to miss it.
Reopening the ghost stations was an important symbolic step for Berliners, but nothing compared with what lay ahead. For West Berlin Mayor Walter Momper, the task of stitching together two torn infrastructures, one of them very threadbare indeed, was daunting.
In 1961, when the city was divided by the wall, it was not only stopping the underground, the electricity, the whole city electricity, the gas net. Everything was cut into two parts. What really shocking was how expensive it is to fix broken telephone lines. There were no telephone lines at all, not between the fire brigades of both parts of the city, not between the police, not between the transport authorities, not between the authorities on both sides.
Did you yourself have a hotline to the east?
No, it was as difficult as for everybody else. If we wanted to talk to the eastern side, we had to go.
The man responsible for reconnecting the city's divided telephone system was Klaus Werner, then the president of Deutsche Telekom.
In 1952,
on the orders of East Germany, the lines were completely cut through. You couldn't phone the other side of the city for nearly 20 years. Only in 1971 was limited traffic established, with only 72 lines running east to west and 460 lines west to east. And each part of the city had a different country code. It was treated as international traffic. That was what it was like until 1989. It was a catastrophic situation. Once the wall was opened, the demands on the communication system were enormous, and it became an even greater catastrophe. We had to resort to emergency measures. For example, we set up special phone boxes at the border so that East Germans could make free calls. That helped ease things. Then we started laying cables over the border and hooked up the two city exchanges. We were constantly racing to keep up.
But it wasn't simply that there weren't enough lines. Fewer than one in five households in the GDR had a phone. East Berliners Kirsten Jürgen and Tatjana Rosse recall having to be very inventive to reach people.
You had to write postcards, you have to write a letter, and you have to go to your friends to see them or to write them a piece of paper to put it in the front of the door.
I didn't have a telephone, and I still remember I had a neighbor who had a telephone. So we arranged appointments when I could receive phone calls from somewhere, mainly from the West, yeah, or when I could call.
Here in the West, we had the most modern networks, fiber optics and some digital. Over there, they had copper cables. It was really primitive. Their technology belonged in a museum, it was so ancient.
Für die Stasi allerdings gab es
the East German secret police, though, the Stasi, there were special phone networks which were very modern. The East German government and big companies had modern systems too, but for the people of the GDR, the phones were really second rate.
While most East Berliners have embraced their new freedoms and the freedom from being constantly monitored by the Stasi, some admit some of the old values have been lost.
Perhaps in this technological time it's very difficult to imagine. I think the house was more open, yeah? Today you have to call it first, your friend, are you available, are you free, do you mind that I'm come? And the other times you're passing by, and this was really not a problem. The time or the way to live before in East Germany made relationships more intense.
Friedrichstrasse station in the heart of the Old East, today lined with lively cafes and shops, was a symbol of the division of Berlin.
Here at Friedrichstrasse, where I saw the tanks, is the one crossing point now left for international diplomatic
visitors. I've watched scores of pathetic scenes as the Westerners back on their side of the wire waved to their kinsfolk over the sentry's head.
Friedrichstrasse was located in the east, but it was the only place where Western trains were allowed to stop. It operated like two stations, divided by its own wall.
The helmeted East German police guarding the barricade have already pointed their guns at us in a threatening way when they saw us.
We are on the eastern platform, as you may say, and between these pillars of the hall, this bigger hall with the four tracks, this was the West Berlin side.
Udo Ditfurt of the S-Bahn Museum.
Here there was a wall with barbed wire underneath and watchtowers, and so there was no chance to go from this platform to the other one without passing the control.
On the 2nd of July 1990, Berlin celebrated another milestone. The first train from east to west Berlin passed through Friedrichstrasse station, and it was driven by the very proud East Berliner Bernd Wolff.
I went to work that morning with the one thought that I'd be driving an empty train and without a destination sign, which is the way it was done in the East. Then my controller said to me, "No, you're going to hang a destination on the front of the train, and you're going to have passengers, and you're going to drive through to the west." So, as I drove into the station at just after 3:30 in the morning, I saw cameras flashing and lots of people, and a journalist, and someone filming the whole thing. It was amazing. Everyone kept asking, how do I feel? Did it feel great? I couldn't indulge in euphoria. I had to concentrate on my job. It was only when I got home in the afternoon that it dawned on me that this was a historic moment.
Get on a bus or a tram today in Berlin, and you'll see that nearly all the old stations have reopened and the ripped-up lines have been reconnected. But it's been a difficult, often fraught process. Today, people seem at pains to gloss over the tensions. But not Michael Wessely, an East Berlin railway engineer who helped rebuild the S-Bahn between East and West.
It was a very interesting and challenging task. The difficulty for me was having to work in West Berlin in new locations, with colleagues from completely different backgrounds, and with systems that I was unfamiliar with. We had to reconstruct old track beds, and in some places, to rebuild lines where no trains had passed for 28 years. Some of the locals were really angry with us that we had destroyed their peaceful existence.
With Berlin caught up in a flurry of rebuilding, tempers were often frayed. Uniting two different cities, in effect, with different histories, politics and cultures, was never going to be easy. As the West Germans took over, accusations of colonisation began to fly.
The East was not really involved into the planning of the East.
Aris Kalandidis worked as an urban planner for the West Berlin government in the early 1990s.
So it was mostly West German, West Berlin architects, West Berlin planners that implemented their vision of the city into East Berlin.
Buildings all over Berlin are being knocked down, constructed or renovated. Many of the socialist landmarks have been demolished. But for many East Berliners, the old Palace of the Republic and the threatened TV tower are part of their lost identity. Bruno Fliehl was East Germany's chief urban planner.
After the end of the GDR, the first idea was this tower has to be demolished. What they want is to get rid of the GDR in all traces.
Are you and your colleagues from the GDR, are you still consulted?
No architect of GDR buildings were ever asked. Here in Berlin, not.
For Aris Kalandidis, one issue particularly highlighted the struggle between the two parts of the city.
West Berlin, after the war, mostly extended the underground system. East Berlin mostly used the tram. What I remember very well is there was a total rejection of the tram by the West. The tram was considered backwards. There were economic interests in building undergrounds. And I remember when the tram was extended from the east to the west for the very first time, it was something like crossing the border once again the other way around. Because it was like the east, suddenly the east planning invading the west. It's as ridiculous as it sounds, that's what it was like.
But these charges of colonisation are rejected by former mayor of West Berlin, Walter Momper.
No, we had a good cooperation between the democratic elected city government of East Berlin after May 1990 and us. You see, we in Berlin, we tried to come together on an equal level, and especially in the political field. Yeah, really, from summer 1990, we started to have the meetings together.
Berlin's division left it with two of everything, including two mayors.
The mayors of East and West Berlin clasped hands on East Berlin's Potsdamer Platz in yet another symbolic meeting.
Greet each other now, a broad handshake, broad smiles on the part of both of them.
In the winter of 1989, high on the agenda of Walter Momper's meetings with his East Berlin counterpart, the late Erhard Krack, was the question of electricity.
What came out after November 9th, that there was, that on the eastern side, Krak had a big fear that he couldn't provide his city any longer with energy. And then we thought about what can we do to help East Berlin. And we asked our city electricity provider, but then it came out they had no lines and they couldn't make them very, very rapidly. You cannot just put a line somewhere to fix two nets which were divided for 28 years.
To find out why it was so difficult to unite Berlin's two electricity grids, I was invited to visit one of the GDR's transformer buildings, still operating.
Absolute blanket of heat. These are the key transformers for the centre of Berlin. We're going in a lift, in a cave.
I was taken underground by Barbara Meifert, who today works for Vattenfall, Berlin's new joint electricity supplier.
From 1952, when the GDR refused to get electricity to West Berlin was a power island. And what that meant was there was no connection to any transmission out of Berlin. West Berlin was just on its own, so they just had the power plants in the city, and they need to rely on them. There was no backup system for the electricity that went to the grid. So this power island needed to be connected to the power world, so to say.
The wall used to run just above our heads. We're crossing a number of grids, steps of grids, and there are now huge cables.
10,000 volts.
10,000 volts.
4 metres below ground, there was a small reception party for me. Kirsten Riesch, who in 1989 was a manager of West Berlin Electricity, and Rainer Goetz, a department head in East Berlin.
Cables on the east side here?
Yeah. It was here that Kirsten and Rainer helped make history.
So it's exactly at this point you brought the cables
together
from the east and you join them up here in this building, in this cellar.
Yep.
And this is what we see here is a physical unification of these two cables from east and west. Yep. And when did that happen?
1992.
Did you have to do a lot of work to bring these two systems together?
Yeah, it was a lot of work. A lot of work, and we worked. It was a hard time. It was a stormy time. 10 or 12 hours a day. We thought we can't handle it because it was too much and too fast.
Was there pressure from politicians, from business to get things done?
From business, mainly from business.
What were they saying?
We have to have it yesterday. We have to be connected yesterday.
I had one more trip underground, although this time the location was smellier and wetter. The city sewers, where I was about to find out that Berlin's division hadn't been quite as complete as we'd thought. I was guided by two former East Berlin water engineers, Ingo Naser and his mate Rainer Kleinfeld, who've worked together for 30 years.
After 1961,
a series of metal barricades were constructed to separate Berlin's sewers and water supplies. So as the Berlin Wall was being built overground, a kind of underground wall was being erected down here to stop people escaping through the tunnels, and several attempts were made. The water and sewage continued to flow freely, but these grills, made of thick iron bars, stopped human access to the sewers under the whole city.
Wasser fließt wie normal, also in der DDR. Das ist nicht, dass man das Wasser abschalten konnte. In the GDR, it was impossible to stop the water flowing from east to west. Is that correct?
Das Wasser ist im ganz normalen Gefälle abgelaufen, so wie es, wie gesagt, vor über 100
Jahren. Water and sewage continued flowing. It was impossible to separate the two water systems.
But during the time of the division, Ingo and Rainer, like all their colleagues in the East, knew none of this. It was classified information.
Even the plans and the maps we had of the East were deliberately altered. We didn't know how the city's sewage system was laid out, or even that the water continued to run east to west. We worked for the water board and weren't even told that those barricades existed. We were kept completely in the dark.
As the two Berlin water authorities came together, as 7,000 plumbers and engineers on both sides struggled to keep their jobs, colleagues from two different cultures were forced to work alongside each other. And this was the case in industries and utilities across Berlin.
Half of them came from the west, half from the east. We were all thrown together. It was clear from the start we worked very differently. In the east, we did much more by hand, and our equipment was more primitive. Their machinery was much more technically advanced.
Kriegt ihr das gleiche Geld? Do you get the same money as your Western colleagues?
Ja, die Entlohnung ist gleich.
Today our pay is exactly the same, but for a few years we got paid 60% less than our Western colleagues. Now we are all equal, and 20 years on, after our two systems were joined, we are all equally worried about keeping our jobs.
Today I hear that concern about jobs all over the city. Prosperity and Chancellor Helmut Kohl's blühende Landschaften, those flourishing landscapes promised to Berliners in 1989, have just not materialized.
Berlin is capital of Germany again, but despite that, it has never regained its former economic power.
Urban planner Udo Dittfurt.
After the wall had come down, there were a lot of expectations about the growth of Berlin and the role Berlin would play in a reunited Europe. And it was expected that the city would grow to 4 million, 5 million inhabitants. And today we still have the same population as 20 years ago.
Berlin has huge debts and high unemployment. It's groaning under the burden of unification.
This new underground line, called the Chancellor's Line, because it runs from the new Bundestag to the Brandenburg Gate, gives an idea of what's wrong. The line has only three stations and runs less than 2 kilometres. It was meant to link up all Berlin's key landmarks, but work has stopped because it's already over budget.
You know, we have, what is it, 60 billion euro now, debt. It's quite a lot for a city and for a land in Germany. It's the highest rate at all.
Former Berlin Mayor Walter Momper.
About 40 billion out of that came from the flats for people to live in, to rent. So that is the highest amount. And the other 20 billion euro, they came from fixing the city again.
Did you realise at the time how much all this was going to cost?
Nobody really realized how much that was. Then the tax increase came, and we still have this Solidaritätszuschlag, as we call it, you know.
A solidarity contribution, yeah. Which each German taxpayer has to pay.
Yeah. Even the taxpayers in East Germany, yeah.
20 years on, Berlin's underground and overground reunification is nearly complete. But along the stitched-together streets and train lines, whispering down the water pipes and fibre optic phone cables, you can still hear from both sides the echoes of those differences and disagreements which sealed the city's original division.
I think, you know, still Berlin isn't a united city. If you see the results of the election, of our last election, you have exactly in the middle between East and West. You know, one part is black and one part is red.
In other words, one part is conservative and the other part is left wing.
Far left wing, yes.
The East still votes socialist.
Yes.
I don't feel united. I don't feel united and others in the same way. I am very much in favor with the united Germany, with the process of unification, but not with the method. The way to come together and to unite that separated country of the past is a task of all Germans. That means to look to the history of both parts of Berlin.
I have to say, 20 years after the wall came down, every time I cross the former border area, there's still a click in my head somehow that I'm now on my side and that's the other side and now I'm on the other side. So it's really each time I cross the border, I still cross the border. So it's still there, this feeling. I think most of us Berliners, and that means people who live in Berlin before the wall came down, still feel that this is the west side and this is the east side.
Do you think you'll ever be living in a truly united city?
Everyone who was
Restitching the City was presented by Rosie Goldsmith. The readers were Nigel Hastings, John Biggins and Bruce Alexander. And the programme was produced by Lawrence Crissell.